From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Karen Hughes has been one of George W. Bush's most trusted advisors for most of his political career. She went to the White House with him to serve as counselor to the president, but she left her position in July 2002, saying she wanted to spend more time with her family, and the family wanted to move back to Texas. She's now working on the president's re-election campaign. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Hughes about advising the president and the controversies now surrounding the White House. She's written a new memoir called 10 Minutes from Normal. Karen Hughes and the Bush White House, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. It was one of the bloodiest days in Iraq under the American occupation. 9 people were killed today, all Americans. U.S. officials say 4 American contracted security guards were the targets of an ambush in the Iraqi town of Fallujah today. An angry crowd was later caught on video, mutilating the Americans' bodies. NPR's Ivan Watson reports from Baghdad.
Local cameramen filmed Iraqis dancing and celebrating as they dragged the charred corpses of the Americans through the streets. Dan Senor, a spokesman for the U.S. Civil Administration in Baghdad, condemned the attack.
Those aren't people we are interested in helping. Those are people we have to capture or kill so this country can move forward.
This was the ugliest example yet of Iraqi hatred for the U.S. occupation, but it was just one of several bloody attacks against the U.S. and its Iraqi allies. 5 American soldiers were killed by a roadside bomb near Fallujah, and a suicide car bomber injured at least 5 Iraqis east of the capital. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Baghdad.
The chief inspector for the U.S.-led coalition authority said today that the growing cost of security and insurance are pushing up reconstruction costs in Iraq. Stuart Brown says security expenses accounted for 15% or more of the total price of Iraqi contracts. He predicts more funding will be needed to cover the growing expense. OPEC members have decided to go ahead with cuts in oil production. The move could push gasoline prices even higher than they are now. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
OPEC approved cuts of 1 million barrels of oil a day earlier this year. With rising energy prices, some members had advocated reversing the cuts. But in a meeting in Vienna, members of the cartel decided to go ahead with the move. Among those backing the cuts was Saudi Arabia. White House officials said they were concerned about rising prices, but stopped short of directly criticizing the cuts. An Energy Department spokesman also said U.S. officials were considering some short-term measures to address record gasoline prices, but he declined to elaborate on what they might be. Despite the OPEC decision, oil prices fell for the day. That happened after a report said U.S. crude oil stocks had reached their highest levels in a year and a half. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
The World Court ruled today that the United States violated the rights of 51 Mexicans now on death row. The justices ordered the Americans to review their cases. It's the second time the highest UN court has ruled the United States broke the 1963 Vienna Convention by denying foreign nationals access to diplomatic assistance. The ruling could mean a reprieve or another chance for appeal for the inmates, including one scheduled to die in Oklahoma May 18th. Stock prices were generally lower on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average off 24, the Dow and the Nasdaq down 6. This is NPR. Scientists have deciphered the genetic blueprint of the Norway brown rat. The intent is to make this sometimes reviled animal more useful in medical research. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Rats spread diseases and are unwelcome residents in cities around the world, but they also have a long history of being useful in medical research. So after scientists read out the genome of human beings and laboratory mice, they turned their attention to the rat. A report in Nature finds that rats have just about the same number of genes as people and mice, but there are subtle differences throughout. Those differences explain not only the whiskers, fur, and naked tails, but they could prove useful in medical research. Scientists hope that by studying and tweaking rat genes, they'll learn about human diseases. And by comparing genes from people, mice, and rats, scientists can learn a lot about how genes function and how they contribute to health and disease. Richard Harris, NPR News, Washington.
Attorneys for Martha Stewart say they want a new trial. They say one of the jurors in her first trial lied about his own criminal record. In papers filed in federal court today, Stewart's attorneys accuse juror Chappelle Hartridge of lying during jury selection to get on the panel. They say Hartridge was arrested for an alleged assault in 1997. The charge was later dropped, but attorneys say that Hartridge claimed in a juror questionnaire he had never been in court other than for a minor traffic violation. The jury convicted Stewart of obstructing justice and lying to the government. U.S. and Canadian officials say they've wiped out one of the largest ecstasy operations on the continent. Authorities say they arrested 130 people in both countries, including two alleged top officers of the international drug ring. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from BBC America, presenting The Office, the innovative British comedy about the banality of 9 to 5, in excruciating detail. Thursday nights at 10 on BBC America.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by TIAA Craft, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org. And from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of The Book of Joe, a novel about what happens when you dare to go home again, by Jonathan Tropper.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Karen Hughes, one of President Bush's most trusted advisors, has written a new memoir called 10 Minutes from Normal. It offers an admiring portrait of the president, in contrast to the criticisms found in the new memoirs by the president's former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark. As counselor to the president during his first 18 months in office, Karen Hughes managed a staff of 43 in the White House communications, speechwriting, and news media offices, and helped write the president's speeches. She was one of the three top people who ran his presidential campaign. During his 6 years as governor of Texas, Hughes served as his communications director. She left the White House in July 2002, saying that her family wanted to move back to Texas and she wanted to spend more time with them. She became a paid consultant to the Republican National Committee, continued to consult with the president, and will be actively working on his re-election campaign. We recorded our interview yesterday, shortly before the announcement that the president had agreed to let Condoleezza Rice testify under oath to the September 11th commission. Karen Hughes, welcome to Fresh Air. You've been described as the most powerful woman who's ever been in the White House. How would you describe the job that you held before resigning from the Bush administration?
Well, Terry, you know, that description always makes me cringe a little. I really considered my job to be in a supporting role, that I was there to help give the president my honest opinion, to help him talk through issues if he wanted to help manage the communications. I always said that my position as counselor really had two hats. One of them was that I oversaw all the communications functions of the White House. That was the Office of Press Secretary and Media Affairs and Communications and Speechwriting. And then the other hat, when I went to Washington, the president asked me to, was more of a policy, sounding board, a friend of the president who knew the president and his philosophy well. The president asked me to sit in on major meetings where major decisions were made and to, you know, explain his philosophy to the people in the room and to let him know what I thought. Because when we first went to Washington, obviously, we had people from Texas who knew the president well. None of us knew Washington very well. And we hired some people from Washington who knew Washington well but didn't know the president as well. And so I think he did a very good job of blending those perspectives on his White House staff.
And the job that you're returning to now?
Well, it's kind of funny, this returning. I'm not sure I ever completely left. When I left the White House, when I told the president that I needed to move my family back to Texas, he asked me at the time, would I still stay involved? And I was delighted to hear that because I wanted to still be involved. I just felt like my family needed to be home in Texas. And I've continued to be involved. I've traveled to Washington at least once a month, usually twice a month. Now, what I am going to do is step up my involvement in his presidential campaign because, you know, I believe a lot of life is a matter of balancing priorities. And one of my priorities this year is to help reelect him because the stakes are so high in the world today. And I think it's important. And so I told him that when I left the White House that I would travel with him full time during the fall campaign the last several months. And so I imagine that after my book tour, my involvement will steadily increase. And then starting about in mid-August, I plan to be traveling full-time with him for the final months.
I want to quote something from your book that I thought was really interesting. You're writing about how you hardly had time to go to the supermarket while you were working for the Bush administration. But when you did, you write, you wondered what fellow shoppers would think if they knew that the woman squeezing tomatoes in the produce section was on the phone with Colin Powell, Don Rumsfeld, and Condi Rice, helping them prepare for the Sunday talk shows. Did you have trouble bridging those two worlds?
Oh, of course. And you know, it's kind of funny because I remember thinking as I stood there that that's one difference, I think, between men who shop and women who shop. I can't imagine my husband standing there squeezing tomatoes. He would just pick the first ones available. And so the quality of our home produce, I think, suffered a little during my White House years. But he did a great job of grocery shopping. Of course, it was hard. It's hard for all of us. And that's really what my book is about. I tried to put a human face on the political process. And the idea that, you know, these people whose names you see in the headlines all the time are not caricatures. They're real people who have to go grocery shopping and have to, you know, plan dinner and have regular lives.
Now, you left Washington because you felt like your son and your husband really needed to be in Texas, particularly your son.
Well, and that I needed to spend more time with them, too,
and that you
to
needed
be fair.
To spend
it was
more time
really
with
all
them.
Of us. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. Okay, so you needed to spend more time with your son, and then you write at the beginning of your book, I have a very normal family, a teenage son who thinks that I am totally annoying, especially when I ask intrusive questions like, how was your day? Or even try to talk to him when he gets in the car after school because he's tired. Tired of talking? I wonder how is that possible, since he doesn't. So, you know, I was thinking about the position you're in of, like, you know, leaving so that you could spend more time with your son. And, of course, your son, it sounds like a lot of teenagers, doesn't really want to spend all that much time with his mother. So, you know, is there a little bit of, like, resentment that goes on in your mind when you leave your job to spend more time with your son and your son doesn't really want to spend that much time?
Well, you know, any parent of teenagers knows that they're very frustrating years. But, Terry, what I found was that the career family juggle gets even harder as your children get older. You know, when your children are toddlers and you come home from work, they drop everything. They're delighted to see you. They come and they play with you, and you can spend time with them. Any parent of a teenager knows that doesn't happen. You walk in the door from the office and no teenager drops everything and comes to talk to their parents. And so you have to be there at times when they want to talk. And that's not very predictable. And sometimes it's late at night. And when I was at the White House, you know, I had to go to bed because I had to get up so early in the morning. And so I found that I increasingly just was not a part of my son's life. And that really troubled me because I felt that I still had responsibilities as a mother and still had things that I wanted to teach him. And one of the best things about being home in Texas is that I had the opportunity to teach my son to drive. And I spent about 9 months, every day he'd come home from school and he would say, so Mom, you want to go driving? It was one of the few things that he wanted to do with me because he wanted to learn to drive. And so we'd go out and we'd get in the car and he'd get in the driver's seat and we'd back out and he'd look at me and say, well, how was your day? And I thought, you know, he seemed like such an adult, and I sort of realized it was a metaphor for what was happening in his life, that he was increasingly in the driver's seat, and I was there to sort of keep him from running over too many curbs, you know, or try to keep him on the right side of the road. And I would have never had that experience had I still been working at the White House, because I didn't get home until it was dark, and you don't want to teach a teenager to drive in the dark.
My guest is Karen Hughes. She was counselor to President Bush. She's now returning to the Bush administration to work on the campaign. She's written a new memoir, which is called 10 Minutes from Normal. Let me ask you about one theory about why you're returning to a more active position in the Bush administration. And this was expressed recently on Fresh Air by Ron Suskind, who wrote the new book about former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, a book which was critical of the president. And he also wrote a profile of you for Esquire magazine when you were leaving the Bush administration to return to Texas. So here's a very short excerpt of the interview he gave on Fresh Air. You say that Karen Hughes, the president's advisor, left the administration not only because she wanted to spend more time with her family, which was her public reason for leaving, but also because she was exhausted trying to be a pragmatic counterweight to the more ideological Karl Rove. Is that based on what other sources told you for the book?
Yeah, that's based on a previous story that I did for Esquire magazine in the summer of 2002. It got some attention because at the centerpiece of it was about Karen Hughes leaving, but Andy Card, the chief of staff, spoke to me in frustration after Karen announced suddenly that she was leaving, that Karen has been the beauty to Carl's beast. Essentially, that Carl goes into so many meetings with the sharp sword of partisanship, and Karen manages to beat that into a plowshare, that she acted thoroughly as a counterweight to Carl. And what Andy Card was concerned about, he was concerned about the fortunes of the president, as almost everyone in the White House is, that Karen's departure would lead to a veering to the right by the White House. You know, that's an opinion that many people in the White House echoed, and it's one that some people, again, let's look at what the evidence shows, some people may point to in terms of what the pattern has been over the past, you know, year and a half, 2 years since Karen left.
Okay, that's Ron Suskind on Fresh Air. Karen Hughes, do you think that would you agree that you're returning to serve as a counterweight to Karl Rove? And do you think in your absence that the Bush administration veered more to the right?
No, Terry. You know, Ron's a very creative guy. And that was I think a lot of people at the White House feel that was a quite embellished story. First, let me say, I loved my job at the White House. I love President Bush. That's why the decision to leave was so hard. It was agonizing. My job was thrilling. I was going to new places and meeting new things, and I was working, learning new things, working on issues that were really important. My friend Condi Rice and I, thanks to Condi Rice, I was traveling to foreign countries and meeting foreign leaders, and my job was fascinating, and so I loved my job. It was very hard to decide to leave, but I truly felt I ultimately decided that I could do a better job fulfilling my responsibilities to the president from Texas than I could serving my family in Washington. And I've continued to be involved. I've been involved in most major speeches from the White House since I've left. I talked to the president frequently. I talked to Carl frequently. I talked to Dan Bartlett, the communications director, frequently. Carl and I have worked together for a long time. I've worked with Carl. I went to work with Carl before I worked with the president, back then George Bush, before he was even governor of Texas. Now, sure, we have differences. We're both strong-willed personalities. Anyone who's ever been in a room with the two of us knows that we're both tough and outspoken and strong-willed people. And we have different perspectives, partly because we have different jobs. My job is the big-picture message. Carl's job, one of his many jobs, he has a lot of jobs, he's a great policy thinker as well, but one of his jobs from the political side is to stitch together coalitions to help pass the president's initiatives in Congress or to help reelect the president or elect the president. And so our jobs are sometimes different, and that I think that's the case on a lot of White House staffs, that a lot of times when you have disagreement, it's because different people are approaching an issue with different perspectives. And that's healthy and important. It's important for the president to hear that diversity of opinion.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Karen Hughes, and she had been counselor to President Bush overseeing communications. She left Washington for a while to spend more time with her family and to allow her family to move back to Texas. Now she's rejoining the Bush administration again in a more formal capacity and will be working on the reelection campaign. She's written a new memoir, which is called 10 Minutes from Normal. Faith is one of the many things you have in common with President Bush. And many people, including some religious leaders, have questioned whether it's appropriate for the president to refer to God and to his religious beliefs in speeches. And that's been questioned for these reasons. Not everyone in America is religious at all. Not everyone who is religious is Christian. And it has been said that believing that God is on your side can be very blinding if you're a president, because you believe that you are right and therefore might not see nuances that legitimately challenge your point of view. So I'm wondering, when you advise the president about his speeches, what advice do you give him about when to and when not to and how to refer to God and his religious beliefs?
Well, Terry, this is a country that was founded on the rock of religious freedom. This is a country that was founded by conviction that we were endowed by our Creator with certain rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we're endowed with rights to include not to believe at all. And that clearly is one of the choices available to people in America. It's interesting you said that about God is on your side, because the morning after September 11th, I believe it was September 12th, I remember Secretary Rumsfeld giving a prayer in the cabinet meeting, and he prayed the prayer that President Lincoln had prayed, not that God would be on our side, but that we would be on God's side. In other words, that we would try to do the right thing. And I just have to say that I would think it's a matter of comfort for people to know that they have a president who is praying for guidance and wisdom, who, you know, our faith teaches to love your neighbor, to be humble, to turn the other cheek, to try to love your enemies. I would think that that's a great comfort to people to know that they have a president who is humble enough to admit the need for a greater authority, to try to make decisions based on a faith that teaches love and compassion and concern for your fellow man.
Well, invading Iraq against the wishes of the United Nations wasn't seen by many people as a humble action, though.
Well, Terry, again, we have the Bible clearly separates render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. You have duties on earth. You also have responsibilities to your faith. And I have to disagree with you that we invaded Iraq under against the wishes of the United Nations. We had a unanimous resolution of the United Nations Security Council. We had a vote of the United States Congress, including the president's Democratic opponent, Senator Kerry, who voted for the use of force in Iraq, although later voted against paying for it. But he did vote for it, as did the overwhelming majority of the United States Congress. The United Nations Security Council unanimously voted to hold Saddam Hussein to account. Remember, this was not us just deciding. This was us trying to enforce the will of the world. Saddam Hussein, for 12 years, had defied the agreements that he had made to end the war that we had previously been engaged in. So this was the President of the United States, and I was there on the floor of the United Nations General Assembly when he gave the speech challenging the world to face up to the defiance and to the repercussions of the defiance. And I think we're already seeing some of the dividends of our decision to go into Iraq when you see leaders like Muammar Gaddafi come forward and voluntarily agree to dismantle his nuclear weapon program. I think you're already beginning to see the fact that this, in fact, will result in a more peaceful world.
My guest is Karen Hughes, former counselor to President Bush. She will be actively working on his re-election campaign. Her new memoir is called 10 Minutes from Normal. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We've recently had on several big newsmakers on Fresh Air, including Richard Clark, Paul O'Neill, Hans Blix, and now Karen Hughes. You never know who you'll hear on the show, but we hope the predictable part is that the guest will be interesting and will be given the time to discuss their work, their views, and their lives. Today, your station needs you to call with a pledge of financial support. I urge you to call now. Thank you. My guest is Karen Hughes, former counselor to President Bush. She will be actively working on the president's re-election campaign. Her new memoir is called 10 Minutes from Normal. The publication of your memoir is coinciding with the Richard Clark book. It's on the heels of the Paul O'Neill book, which are both very critical of the Bush administration. It's coinciding with the September 11th commission investigations, which are so controversial now. Is this good news or bad news for you? I mean, on the one hand, you get a chance to offer your opinion and to refute a lot of what's being said, but on the other hand, it's kind of taking away from the message you intended to get out.
Well, it's an interesting question because it's not really what my book is about. my book is about life. and about setting priorities in life and about the struggle we face to balance our career and our family and about how my faith, in my case, helps me set my priorities in life and how we all need to maybe sometimes take time away from what keeps us busy to think about what's really important and how we allocate our time. I also talk about my passion for the women and girls of Afghanistan. I worked on that issue when I was at the White House, and I've been to Afghanistan now twice. And you know, I was there a month or two ago, and women are going back to work, and little girls are going back to school, and it's a very optimistic story. And so I have to admit, I don't really like it being viewed in the context of some of these other political gossip books. I'm a little, you know, distressed that's the way it is, but that is the way it is. And so I do think that my book, I think the most historical book that has been written to date about the Bush administration was Bob Woodward's Bush at War. And I think that if you will read my book and read Bob's book, that you'll find the portrayal of the president is very similar. And that's because that's the way he was. He was in command. He was decisive. He was principled. I remember feeling like he was carrying us all through that great crisis through his sheer will and just force of personality. And so, you know, I think that Bob's book reflects that, and I know my book reflects that because that's what I saw every day in the person I was working with.
President Bush is now supporting an amendment to the Constitution that would outlaw gay marriage by defining marriage as a union between one man and one woman. I've heard a lot of people talking about what's behind that. Some assume it's the president's deep belief. Other people challenge that and say, no, it's pressure from the religious right. He needs their support. And he owes them this. What is behind his support of this amendment?
Terry, I've worked for the president a long time, and I've never seen him respond because of pressure. He responds based on principle and what he thinks is right. He believes that the institution of marriage is an institution between a man and a woman, that it is one of the most enduring institutions, perhaps the most enduring institution of our civilization, that it is important part of our family society, of our civilization, and he believes that it needs to be defended. He, as you know, President Clinton signed the Defense of Marriage Act that was passed by Congress in the previous administration. The lawyers have advised that they believe that may not withstand a legal challenge, and that's why the president came out in support of a constitutional amendment to define marriage as between a man and a woman. Now, that said, the president also is a very compassionate person who has a great deal of respect for individuals. He believes, however, the institution of marriage is between a man and a woman and should be constitutionally defined as such.
I wonder if you've spoken to Vice President Cheney about the position that he's in. His administration wants to amend the Constitution to make sure that Dick Cheney's own lesbian daughter can't have the same rights as heterosexuals.
I have not personally talked with the Vice President about that issue, but I have seen him quoted that he is supportive of the President's decision.
Is homosexuality or divorce the greater threat to marriage?
Well, I think, Terry, clearly that we all wish that more marriages didn't end in divorce. It's important, I think, that our society value marriage and work to strengthen marriage. It's, as I say, one of the enduring bedrocks of our civilization. It's important for the nurture of children. There are a lot of forces that threaten marriage, and I think it's important that we all work to strengthen it and to celebrate its role in our society.
Karen Hughes, her new memoir is called 10 Minutes from Normal. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Karen Hughes responds to some of the criticisms of Richard Clark, President Bush's former counterterrorism chief, who recently testified to the September 11th commission.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Aveda, an earth-conscious beauty company committed to preserving natural resources and finding more sustainable ways of doing business. Information available at aveda.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Karen Hughes. She served as counselor to the president during George W. Bush's first 18 months in the White House, then left, saying her family wanted to move back to Texas and she wanted to spend more time with them. She's continued to consult with the president and will be actively working on his re-election campaign. Her new memoir is called 10 Minutes from Normal. You feel very strongly about President Bush. You've worked with him since he ran for governor in Texas. You knew him when you were working with the Republican Party in Texas. You know, you've been with him for a long and very successful ride. I'd like to hear your reaction to something that Richard Clark said on Fresh Air last week. And Clark was talking about the memo that he'd written showing that there was no connection between al-Qaeda and Iraq. The memo was sent back to him, he says, with instructions to redo it and update it. He wrote it again, sent it back, still showing no connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda. But he says the memo was never shown to the president, and Clark thinks that that's because it didn't give the message the Bush administration wanted. Let me play you what he said about that.
Well, you know, my impression is that the people around the president don't show him things that don't accord with their views or his views. This is not a White House that is interested in analysis, pros and cons, evaluation. They kind of have the conclusions, and they want only information that supports the conclusions.
What's your response to what Richard Clark is saying, Karen Hughes, that the Bush administration doesn't want to see things that it doesn't agree with?
Well, Terry, I just have to say, I've worked for the president for 10 years, and I don't recall ever being almost in any meeting where I didn't hear vigorous debate. So I just have to say that is just not true. I know the president perhaps better than almost anyone except for his wife and family. I've been with him through countless debates and arguments and discussions. The president, I sat through numerous briefings where the president asked tough questions and probed members of his staff, where he wanted different opinions. And I have to say that I've really been very troubled by a lot of what Mr. Clark has said, because I think it's very, very distorted. And that's really unfortunate, because let me just give you one example. The first time I remember sitting in an extended meeting with him with Richard Clark was the week after September 11th. And he was there because Condoleezza Rice had sent him to my office to brief me on Afghanistan, because President Bush had made the decision to go after al-Qaeda in Afghanistan because he had determined that those were the people who were responsible for the September 11th attacks. Not Iraq, Afghanistan. I was at the White House the night of Sunday, September 16th, in the residence with the president and Condoleezza Rice as he talked to us about his decision to go after al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Richard Clark was not there. I was there. And so I just feel that, unfortunately, what the result of what he has said has led the American people to a very distorted view of what actually happened. And the problem with that is that I think it's left America with a sense of misplaced responsibility. The only people responsible for the attacks of September 11th were al-Qaeda, not some intelligence workers in the U.S. government, not the Bush administration, not the Clinton administration. I'm not known as a champion of the Clinton administration, but I'll speak up on their behalf on this. I don't think had anyone in the Clinton administration for 8 years, in the Bush administration for that first 8 months, had anyone been able to put together the pieces and done something that would have prevented this attack, they would have. And I think it's really unfortunate that Mr. Clark's testimony and comments have led America to this sense of misplaced responsibility, as if someone here were to blame, instead of placing the blame where it truly belongs, which is on al-Qaeda.
Well, let me just play one more comment that he made. And this was relating to his charge that there's not enough, that the Bush administration didn't pay enough attention to the terrorist threat before September 11th. And this was Richard Clark recorded last week on Fresh Air.
I had asked early on, I think 2 or 3 days into the Bush administration in January, to have a cabinet-level meeting, following which we could have a presidential meeting. And I was told, well, no, we're not going to do that. You're not going to get to see the president on terrorism. We're going to have a policy development process and review terrorist policy in general. And we'll do that in a couple of months. We'll start at the deputy secretary level. And that process dragged on until September 4th, when finally we had the cabinet-level meeting that I had requested urgently in writing very early in the administration, 3 days into the administration.
Karen Hughes, what are your comments about his critique that the Bush administration was incredibly slow to respond to the al-Qaeda threat and the possibility of a terrorist attack?
Well, Terry, I think we have to look at the facts. First of all, when he came into office, President Bush continued the Clinton policy. He continued to vigorously pursue all the policies that President Clinton had in place to deal with al-Qaeda. But not just that. What the president decided at one point in the spring of 2001, much before the September 11th attacks, my understanding, I remember Condi Rice or Steve Hadley, one of the two of them, telling me that the president had told them that he was tired of swatting at flies, that he wanted to develop a more comprehensive, a more aggressive policy against al-Qaeda than the policy he was already implementing, which was the policy put in place by his predecessor. And so they were in the process of developing that policy. The president did a number of other things as well. He decided, based on concerns about the threats around the world, that he wanted to meet daily with the top intelligence official in the country, CIA Director George Tenet. He met with him every day. Former President Clinton did not do that. During the summer of 2001, when the threats began to spike, most of the threats, my understanding is, most of them were related to potential attacks in foreign countries, not in this country. Despite that, the president convened a meeting and asked his people to consider the possibility of an attack in our homeland and to consider ways we could guard against it, to put our agencies on higher alert, and those higher alerts were issued. So I just don't think the facts bear out Mr. Clark's story, and I think 2020 hindsight is very nice, and I noticed the other day in one of his interviews he gave the benefit of 2020 hindsight to the Clinton administration. I wish that he would perhaps give the same benefit to the Bush administration. But again, I don't think anyone in our government could have put the pieces together based on what I know and prevented these attacks. And I think it's just unfortunate that he has created the misimpression that perhaps someone other than al-Qaeda is responsible for these attacks.
My guest is Karen Hughes, former counselor to President Bush. She will be actively working on his re-election campaign. Her new memoir is called 10 Minutes from Normal. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Karen Hughes, former counselor to President Bush. She will be actively working on the president's re-election campaign. Her new memoir is called 10 Minutes from Normal. Both Richard Clark and Paul O'Neill in their books say that Iraq was at the top of the agenda of the Bush administration when it first came into the White House, and that that's probably part of the reason why Iraq was invaded after September 11th. You know, a while after September 11th, but after September 11th. Looking back on the decision to invade Iraq, knowing now that there appear to be no weapons of mass destruction, that no discernible connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda, we're still witnessing terrorist attacks and an insurgency in Iraq. We're trying to hand over sovereignty in June, but there's still chaos and attacks there. We're there to create democracy, but the other day we padlocked a newspaper that we thought was writing lies. Do you think that the Bush administration is having any second thoughts about the invasion of Iraq? I mean, is it fair to say it didn't go the way they expected?
Terry, no, I don't think they're having any second thoughts, and I think that we fully expected that this would be hard. I remember a conversation I had with Condi Rice when we were talking about challenging the world. At the time, we were still hoping we could avoid a war. She was talking about going to the United Nations and challenging the world to face up to the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. And she told me, she said, Karen, this is going to be really hard. And I remember looking at her and saying, but is it right? And she said, absolutely. And I later had much the same conversation with the president, and I think they would say the exact same thing today. And I think they believe and strongly feel that America and the world are safer and better off today because Saddam Hussein is no longer in power, because that regime is no longer in place at the heart of a very volatile region of the world in the Middle East. You know, I want to say a few words about the weapons. First of all, I don't think we've heard the final word yet. David Kay came back, the chief weapons inspector, and did conclude that he believes we were wrong about the weapons. Now, let me talk about we. We, he said, is a lot wider than the Bush administration. We includes former President Clinton and Vice President Gore, who felt that Saddam had weapons. After all, the whole policy of regime change, of that our country wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein's regime, was developed in the Clinton administration in 1998. So wrong about the weapons, he said. We were wrong about the weapons. Well, that also included Senator Kerry, who said numerous times that he thought that Saddam's weapons were a threat. In fact, Senator Kerry said it would be naive to the point of grave danger not to think that at some point in the future he would try to use those weapons to confront the civilized world, because he had done so in the past. David Kay believes that we were wrong about the weapons, but he also had another important conclusion that I don't think the American people heard, and it wasn't on the cover of Newsweek magazine. He said, while he thought we were wrong about the weapons, he also thought we were absolutely right about the war. And he said that Iraq was an even more dangerous and more unstable place than we had realized when we went in there. And Terry, we have to look at the world. It's interesting. One of the arguments that people are making in front of the 9/11 Commission right now is that we should have perhaps been able to preempt a strike by al-Qaeda on September 11th. Well, in the aftermath, I don't think it was possible for us to predict that before September 11th, but in the aftermath of September 11th, it is very important that we're able to look at the world and try to prevent the nightmare scenario, which is that terrorists, who we know want to kill as many people as possible, might someday be able to marry up with the weapons to help them kill people on a massive scale, with weapons of mass destruction. And we have to do everything in our power to prevent that.
The argument on the other side is that the invasion of Iraq has strengthened the terrorists. We took troops out of Afghanistan to send to Iraq. We've taken money that might have gone into Homeland Security to fund the invasion of Iraq, and Iraq has become a magnet for terrorists now. You can agree or disagree with that. These are arguments that are being made. I'm just presenting them.
No, and I understand that, Terry. And I would say that better that magnet be in Iraq than be here in our own country. Better we face the terrorists and meet them in Iraq than we do in the streets of New York City or Philadelphia or Washington, D.C. I don't buy the argument that fighting terrorism...
Do you think they're mutually exclusive? Well, like if there's terrorists in Iraq, that means they're not going to be here?
Well, I think what it means is that I don't buy the argument that fighting terrorism creates terrorists. There are terrorists around the world, and many thousands of them were trained in Afghanistan during the 1990s in al-Qaeda's training camps, and then they dispersed around the world. They're located around the world, including the hijackers of September 11th were in our own country for quite some time before they launched their attacks, and so I have no doubt that there are terrorists around the world, but I do think it's important that we fight them in various places around the world, including in a place that was very unstable, that potentially they could access weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
You had been very involved in speech writing and public messages from the Bush administration. Are there any speeches that spoke with certainty about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and spoke with certainty about the link between al-Qaeda and Iraq that you wish you could rewrite now and like tone down or change in some way?
Well, Terry, I think all a president and all leaders can do is communicate the facts as they know them. And we believed that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. After all, Saddam Hussein had had them before, had used them before on his own people. I don't know how to answer that other than to say that we tried to convey the information we had at the time. There's been a lot of talk about the President's State of the Union speech. That speech was based on the National Intelligence Estimate, which is the document that is developed and given to policymakers on which to make their policy decisions. And so the President communicated those facts with the American people. And there's still, we still don't, I think, have the final word on Iraq. I will point out that on weapons there, I will point out that the CIA director, George Tenet, has said that we still have more work to do and that when it's all complete, well, then we'll know with certainty. Now, clearly, David Kaye believes that we were wrong about the weapons. And if that's the case, we need to know. And that's why President Bush has appointed a commission to look into it, not a political commission to try to politicize this issue in an election year, but a commission to take a thoughtful look and to report, because whoever the next president is, we need to know. If all the collective intelligence of the world was wrong, we need to know why.
I'd like to hear your impressions of the press. Are members of the press fair when they criticize the Bush administration for being more secretive and more closed than most presidential administrations?
You know, I don't know the comparison, Terry, because I have to admit, Washington is not my experience. I do know in Texas, we have a very open Public Records Act, and I was always very vigorous about enforcing it. When reporters would ask for information and our lawyers would want to withhold and wait the longest period of time possible, I'd say, no, that's public information. We're giving it now. It needs to be accessible to the public. So I don't think we had a pattern of that. Now, the press will tell you that we had a pattern in Texas of being very disciplined and very on message. And what they mean by that is that I wouldn't go to the bar at night and criticize my boss behind his back. I'm not that kind of person. I wouldn't be working for the president if I didn't believe in him. So I, you know, a lot of people, I think, see the political process as a game. And that may be one of the differences between me and some of the people who you know, go from candidate to candidate to candidate trying to elect someone so that they can go to work at the White House. I never did that. And I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying that's different. I think what they mean by secretive is that there are not a lot of leaks. And I think actually leaks are very destructive. And let me give you an example of where a place where I thought leaks were very destructive. It happened right after I left the White House. The president had talked to me before I left the White House, and we had talked about that if he had to go to confront Iraq, if we could not convince Saddam Hussein to live up to his agreements, that if we had to confront Iraq and we had to go to the world, that he wanted the approval of the United States Congress because he wanted the complete moral authority of our country. Well, that had not been public yet. We had talked about it, and I knew he had every intention of going to Congress if he had to take that act. So in August, I'm sitting at my kitchen table in Texas, and a memo is leaked from the White House Office of General Counsel. This memo legally concluded that the president didn't have to go to Congress to get support. It was leaked. It got us off on the wrong foot in Europe because basically Europe had the idea, oh, that Texan is going to go unilaterally off and declare war. Well, nothing could be further from the truth, and I knew that because I knew the president had already decided he was going to go to Congress. So that's an example of where a leak was, in my view, very destructive to the national interest of our country.
My final question is going to have absolutely nothing to do with national security. It is, however, something that was told to us by the Washington Post White House correspondent Dana Milbank, and that is this, that Karen Hughes, you have a hard time finding shoes that fit because you have large feet.
I do. And this is a wonderful story, and I didn't tell it in the book because it never fit anywhere, and I wanted to tell it in the book, and I wrote it, actually, but it never fit. I wear a size 12 shoe. I used to wear a size 11 shoe. I crammed my feet into a 10.5 for my wedding on sandals with my toes sticking out over the edges, but then after I had my son, my feet grew, and I wear a size 12 shoe, and so I had a very hard time finding shoes until I finally found this wonderful little shoe store called Shoe Styles in Austin, Texas. And the man who ran the shop, I was raving because he had all these beautiful sandals, purple and pink. And I remember him saying to me, I said, you have such wonderful shoes. And he said, oh, yes. He said, the transvestites love them. They're some of my very best customers.
So. Well, on that note, Karen Hughes, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry, for having me. I really appreciate it.
Karen Hughes is former counselor to President Bush and will be actively involved in his re-election campaign. Her new memoir is called 10 Minutes from Normal. This is Fresh Air. Karen Hughes is the latest newsmaker to speak on Fresh Air. We've also recently heard from Paul O'Neill, Richard Clark, and Hans Blix. Today, we're asking you to consider the newsmakers, the writers, the actors, musicians, artists, and experts from nearly every field who you hear on Fresh Air, and we're asking you to make a financial pledge to support the program and your station. I hope you'll call now. Thank you. Nashville is naturally thought of as the home of country music, but a new exhibit that opened last week at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum shows off its significant blues, rhythm and blues, and soul presence. The Hall of Fame has released a double CD called Night Train to Nashville to go along with the exhibition. Rock historian Ed Ward has a review.
Everyone knows Nashville as Music City, USA, but nearly everybody thinks that refers to only one kind of music. But it's a city with a lot of recording studios and a lot of studio musicians, neither of which like to be idle for long. And it's also got a large African-American population. So after World War II, a Nashville man named Jim Bullitt joined the crowd of entrepreneurs setting up little record labels. He recorded anyone he could get his hands on, including B.B. King, Rufus Thomas, and Cecil Gant, a Nashville blues man who'd had a huge hit while he was still a private in the Army during the war.
Used to be young and handsome. Ain't it a doggone shame? A woman took all my money and left me standing in the rain. Nashville really jumped. Jumping all night long. I'd rather be in Nashville.
There was talent everywhere in Nashville, even in the prisons.
Just walking in the rain, getting soaking wet, torture in my arms. Trying to forget, just walking in the rain.
The prisoners were housed in Tennessee State Penitentiary, where lead singer Johnny Bragg was doing time. They drove with a trustee guard to Memphis to record Walking in the Rain for a new label called Sun, giving it its first regional hit. Bragg was eventually released from prison and went on to help another new label, Nashville-based Excello, have its first top 10 R&B hit with his group, The Marigolds.
Rolling Stone.
I'm a big and rolling stone.
Rolling Stone, just a rolling stone. Rolling Stone, just a rolling stone. Rolling Stone, just a rolling stone. One day you'll be all alone.
Another Nashvillian who appeared in the mid-50s went on to become familiar to American music fans, whether they knew it or not. He was still an unknown college student, though, when he recorded this.
I was standing on the corner on 6th of May when the police came up and they took me by the hand.
Well, he led me down to the Davidson County Jail, and I'm looking for Christine to come and go my bail. Christine, Christine, oh, Christine.
Baby, someone with very good ears might have figured out that the alto sax intro there was by Hank Crawford, who became bandleader for Ray Charles, who I have to say sings better than Hank. One way a lot of black Nashville music got exposed was via a radio station heard all over the Midwest, WLAC, where DJs like Bill Hoss Allen and John R. Richburg played a lot of the local hits and occasionally turned them into national hits. Arthur Alexander moved to Nashville to be near his label, and his country-tinged singing proved popular not only in the U.S., but in Britain, where he was an idol to the Beatles and many others. Even as the soul era turned the spotlight over to Memphis, Nashville kept on going. Bobby Hebb recorded his smash Sonny there, Joe Tex recorded practically everything he ever cut there, and Joe Simon's The Chokin' Kind actually features a pedal steel guitar way down in the mix. Sometimes the backing band was all country musicians moonlighting. Jerry Kennedy's electric sitar and Peggy Scott and JoJo Benson's Soul Shake, and the other players read like the session list of any A-Team country recording from 1969. At this point, though, regional popular music scenes all over America started to wane, and Black Nashville was no exception. Still, there's 35 years worth of great stuff available on record, and shouldn't Music City mean everybody's music?
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He reviewed Night Train to Nashville, produced by the Country Music Hall of Fame. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Jessica Chu, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as Easter approaches, we take a historical look at crucifixion as a form of execution. We talk with John Dominic Crossan, one of the leading scholars of the historical Jesus and author of the books The Birth of Christianity and Who Killed Jesus. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.